Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
And God knows how much longer this channel is going to be up because big tech is doing a big communist purge. So go to BitChute, Rumble, Parler, Gab, follow me, follow Dale, follow everyone, because these 30 communists are trying to take over. And rumor is that they are giving strikes for anything talking about January 6th. And I'm going to draw my line in the sand right from the get-go. I'm not going to take anything down, so I'll probably be banned. But my logic is 14 days to flatten the curve, and look where we are now. It's never going to stop. So yeah, so if my channel goes away, go to BitChute or Rumble or Gab or Parler, and but Dale Comstock, back in the fucking saddle. Dr. Delta Force Dale Comstock, PhD, black belt of the sixth degree. We're talking about his book, American Badass, which will be linked in the description and stickied in the top comment. We did chapter one last week, and now we are on chapter two. This whole podcast series is just the American Badass Chronicles, volume one. This is volume two. And enough of my dumbass talking. Dale, take it away.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, man. And for everybody listening out there, we've done chapter one before. Actually, chapter one was a couple of chapters out of the book. This one, we'll call it chapter two, but it actually starts at around chapter five in the book. So I'm packing a lot of stuff in there. And I'm not reading the chapters. I'm just going to tell the story. So a couple of things. Yeah. We're living in some crazy times. And, Tom's right. There's a movement away for me, especially, and I know Tom, to get away from some of these the liberal platforms like Facebook and YouTube. You'll find me on Parler now, and I'm on Rumble, and I'm just trying to migrate from all the craziness, and hopefully those don't get shut down either. But anyways, I got a story to tell, and if my book's called American Badass, and I won't go into my background or how did I come up with the name. Things like that. You can hear all that in the first episode that we did in chapter one. But essentially, the book that I'm going to be talking about today, the chapters within the book, is called American Badass. And the titles are misleading. In fact, not only is the title misleading, the front cover is misleading, right? It's got an American flag. It's got me there with no shirt on, big chain around my neck. I'm all yoked and stuff with no shirt on. It says American Badass, and probably first glance, most people will walk by and go, what is that about? Like a prisoner, a guy in a penitentiary, right? And it's not, right? And I'm hoping the girls check it out. I go, oh, look at naked guy. I didn't pick it up. But no, it's American Badass is really about being what I call, laughingly, a good ass, right? Being a good guy, good patriot, good father, good citizen, trying to do all the right things, right? That's American Badass. And it's not about how tough you are, how many people you can beat up or kill or things like that, right? It's that doesn't make you a badass, right? That just makes you a dumbass. My mind, a badass is a person that tries to exemplify the right thing. What is the right thing? I know that's all relative, especially today. what we thought was right is now wrong, and what is wrong is now right. It's like, ooh, everything's upside down, right? Yeah. So you figured out for yourself what that means. But I'm just going to share with you some of my history, some of my stories. I use my stories to motivate and inspire people to be better versions of themselves. So today what I want to talk about is called Babies and Bullies and the Patriarchs. And what is Babies and Bullies? Basically, it's my story growing up. So you get a little bit of background information on how did I get to where I am today, 57 years later. And it's even amazing that I got this far at 57 years. I should have been dead like a long time ago. I was talking to Arlene Tour. She's an actress and a good friend of mine years ago. And I was telling her about something that happened to me that I was almost killed and a couple of things. And then she's like, oh, my God, you're like a cat with nine lives. And I was like, no, I'm like a litter of kittens, because,
seriously, though, yeah.
I've been just so lucky. And I'm thinking, somebody is saving me for something down the road, you know. And because if you listen to chapter one, you'll hear the story in there about, again, how I, dodged fate, on a TV set. But, here I am. So I was born in 1963. I am 57 years old, come up on 58, but I sure as heck don't feel like it. I don't think I look like it. In fact, most people think I'm about 40. I don't feel it, I don't have any, I've had a lot of injuries, but I don't have the aches and pains that go with it or anything. I feel like, a 25-year-old kid. I really do. I'm in great shape. I feel good. I don't wake up in the morning and go, oh, my back, my knee. None of that stuff's happening to me, right? And there's a reason for all that. Now I'll talk about that later as well. I was born in 1963. I was born in Fort Lewis, Washington. My father was in the Army for 20 years. He was stationed up there, and I was born in Madigan Hospital up there, Army Hospital. And my mother's German. My father met my mom in Germany when he went over there on his first tour. And, he was 20, I believe, at the time. He met my mom. She was 17. And then right after that, I showed up. So I spent most of my childhood and teenage years growing up in Germany. And in large part, I was raised by my family, my German family over there as well. Having said all that, growing up, growing up in the military culture was very unique and, a very good experience, actually. All I knew growing up as a baby onward till the age of, almost 18 was military life. I lived on military, facilities, quarters. I went to school with other military kids. I hung around other military kids. And we all kind of had the same way of thinking, the same types of disciplines that that we learned from our fathers mm-hmm. and our mothers, And then I remember when I got out, my dad retired the Army. He actually retired from Fort Huachuca, Arizona. And he got a job up in San Francisco in the Bay Area at a company called, I think it was called Rantron Systems. My father was a communicator, right? And worked with communications and radios. And we moved up there. And I got to tell you, it was a culture shock for me. Living in the Bay Area, at the age of 15, I was like, whoa, this was so uncomfortable. So uncomfortable. It's very hard to explain, but I didn't have any friends. I was almost like a recluse. I had a hard time making friends. I just felt so out of my element, it was the strangest thing because I would go to school, didn't talk to nobody. Nobody talked to me. Then after school, I had nobody to hang out with. It's just me going home and going to my bedroom, lifting weights, it was really surreal, man. I mean, I remember walking the streets by myself at night, had nobody to hang out with. I just felt like something's, my life is missing, man. What I was used to, I yearned for it. And then we finally moved to Sacramento, California. My dad started his own insurance business, out of the garage in our house, that we bought. He did very well, man. He was very successful. I learned a lot from my father, which I'll talk about in the next chapter, the patriarchs. So that came, there came a point where, I realized I gotta, when I get out of high school, what am I gonna do? I didn't want to go to college. My dad wanted me to go to college. Nobody in my family on either side had ever been to college. In fact, my dad had an 11th grade education. My mom had a 9th grade education. And it was my dad's wish to see his son be the first college graduate, mm-hmm. out of both sides of the family. And as much as I would have liked to, accommodate that, I got to tell you, man, that calling for the military was stronger than anything else. And I just felt like there's no way I'm ready to go to college, man, yeah. and be around more of these freaking knuckleheads, right? Yeah. It just didn't add up. And so I actually secretly ran down a recruiter's office when I was 17, didn't tell my dad, and signed up for the Army, right? And then I finally had to tell him, and it just broke his heart. And I realized I made a mistake to some degree, but I told him I would make it up to him. And that I would, no matter what, I would get that college degree, mm-hmm. And I actually did in the military. I got my bachelor's and my master's degree on the side, burned that midnight oil. I got my doctorate later on. So anyways, a little bit about my childhood, man. What kind of, you know, when I look at the kids today, they're, you know, I'm not saying all kids, right? So there's some good kids out there, right? Good teenagers. It just depends on the homes they come from. But I got to say, man, what I've seen generally, the kids of today are not like the kids of yesterday, you know, mm-hmm. at least not in my time growing up. Growing up in Germany, you know, we lived in a close knit, you know, military community. And I remember, you know, what I remember the most growing up was, you know, all the friends that we had, you know, and we knew we were only going to be friends for 2 or 3 years yeah. until our fathers rotated out of the country yeah. and moved on. Right. It was like, we're all got 3 years, man. You know, make new guy shows up, you know, and you know, it's like, we're all on a clock, man.
Yeah.
And we made the most of it. And what I really remember the most, though, and I enjoyed the most, is we would play football every day, especially in the wintertime. And it's cold in Germany, right? September, October, November, December, January, February, man, it starts getting cold and rainy and snowy and muddy. And we would go in the backyard. We had this big fields behind our we lived in these apartments, like these 3-4-story apartments. And after school, we'd go out there. And I remember our fathers would get issued cleats, mm-hmm. Army, these cleats, these rubber cleats. It looked like Converse with cleats on the bottom, right? And I got these PT uniforms, you know, which was kind of cool. And our dads would, you know, give us their cleats, you know, and it was great for playing in the mud, right? So we had rubber cleats and we'd go out there and just get muddy as shit, you know, playing football. And all the kids from our neighborhood and the girls would be out there playing, you know. And we would play and play for hours into the darkness, you know. And then I remember, you know, the moms would open up the windows and look out the apartment windows and start yelling. My mom always, Dale Holland, you know. That man, get your ass home. It's time for dinner, right? Like, okay, mom, 5 more minutes, mom, you know. And we would just play and play and play, you know. And even in the summertime, you know, we would, you know, sports was a big part of growing up, man. And you know, we did all the things that you know, chasing girls, dude. You know, man, we chased girls all the time, you know. I was always hanging out at some girl's house, you know, and you know, playing sports, and you know, the boys hanging out. I was just, you know, boys were boys and girls were girls, man. We just had a great time growing up. I remember playing Army all the time growing up too. You know, that was the other thing that was cool is our fathers all got issued TA-50, right? Which is military gear, helmets, load bearing equipment, all the stuff they needed, field gear, right? And they all got it issued because it was Germany. It was during the Cold War. Our fathers were often in the field, you know, on maneuvers. And of course they needed all the equipment, but when they weren't using it, it was stored at home. And of course, me and my friends, we loved that, right? Because we would wear all our dad's gear, right? Our helmet, their helmets and load bearing gear, you know, and we'd go out with freaking rubber band guns and stuff, you know, and we'd play Army, man. We had some great wars, you know, around the neighborhood, you know, and got pretty sophisticated. I remember we used to make mortars out of cans. Back then, the Coke cans were not aluminum like they are today. They were like steel cans, right? They were really sturdy. And what you do is you cut the bottoms out, and then you tape them all together, right? So you make a tube, and then the last can at the bottom, you don't cut the bottom out of that, but about an inch up, you just kind of put a little hole in it with, you know, whatever, just punch a hole in it, and you fill that up with rubbing alcohol, right? And then what you do is you take a tennis ball, you drop it down the top, and then you light the bottom, and you had a mortar. This thing would fly 300-500 meters, man, depending on how long the tube was, right? And so we would build mortars and stuff like that, you know, man, I just had a blast, you know. It just every day, you know, and that was my life growing up, you know. Even we moved to Georgia, Fort Gordon, Georgia, and we'd play in the woods. We'd build underground bunkers, you know, and then just did cool Army stuff, man, you know, you know, girls were part of it, you know, and then, you know, I remember the other thing was, you know, when I got into my teenage years, you know, girls became more important, you know, the hormones started kicking in and fighting was like, you know, that was just part of freaking growing up, man, yeah. You know, you got bullied, you fought back. If you got bullied, you didn't fight back, you got beat up, right? Yeah. And, you know, and you don't go home and cry to mommy and daddy, you know. And I can remember, so this is what I really appreciate about my dad. You know, let's talk about bullying a little bit. So I was a runt, man. I was a little kid. All right. Actually, my mom and dad were both 5'5", I believe. So that I was, my parents were munchkins, man. And I don't know how I ended up almost 6 feet tall. You know, my dad weighed like, you know, when he was really wet, 160 pounds, you know, and I'm like at the heaviest 226 pounds. So I often look at my mom and go, what did the milkman look like, mom? You know, because it's like a milkman back then. Right? In fact, in Germany, they didn't have, they used to bring these cases, right? They would deliver them to your doorstep with beer, and they had this thing called Karl Marts. And I'm no trouble enunciating right now, but that was actually a mixture of Coca-Cola and beer. Now, in Germany, kids could drink beer, right? Growing up, I didn't really like beer growing up. Tastes like shit, like sweet stuff. So the Karl Marts was good because you had Coca-Cola in it, right? Mm-hmm. So that would get delivered to our doorstep all the time, you know? So, you know, maybe it was a beer delivery guy. I don't know what that looked like. I don't know, man. But, you know, but no, I look at my, you know, my pictures, man, and I definitely see the, you know, the family resemblances to some of my, my elders. But, you know, back then, man, it was different, man. You know, if you had a problem with another kid on the playground or the classroom, yes, you took care of it, man, you know? And oftentimes, almost always, you got in a fight, when it was all over in the dust cell, you shook hands and you were friends, right? And mm-hmm. that happened all the time, man. It was all the time, man. And that's how it was, you know? Because let's face it, man, the reality is this. We're social creatures and we have a hierarchy, right? You're going to have the dominant. You're going to have the not so dominant. You're going to have the, you know, subordinate, right? It's just like any other social, you know, social groups, you know, whether it's chimpanzees or horses or you know, a wolf pack or a lion pride, whatever it is, man, it's the same thing, right? There's a hierarchy. And it's evolutionary. Why, man? It's because, you know, it has to do with propagating and perpetuating the species, you know? And so let the strongest breed. We're no different than that. And regardless of what your religious beliefs are, it's, you know, you can't deny it, man. It's always been that way. And so, you know, growing up, you know, problems were solved, you know, with fists, man, mm-hmm. you know? And so I remember there were times, man, I was always getting bullied because I was a little runt, man, but I always fought back. I was a tough little son of a bitch. I didn't lose no fights, man. I was hell on wheels because both my mom and dad had really bad tempers.
Yeah.
My mom was like super aggressive. She was like the German, like really like the stereotype.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Typical German freaking woman, man. You know, oh my God, man. And, you know, didn't take no shit. My dad was really the cooler and calmer of the two. But if you lit his fuse, dude, he'd go off, right? Mm-hmm. Even if he was a little dude, he lost his shit. And he was very protective of me and my sister and my family. And so was my mom. So I was raised with that already, right? And I can remember, man, there were times where I remember one time I get in this fight with this kid behind my house on the playground. It was just, you know, whatever. I can't even remember what it was about. He was always picking on me, right? He was the kid that was over there playing with my other friend. He'd walk up behind me with his finger and then flick me on the ear, right? And then run away.
Yeah.
You know, or come on, hit me with a rock in the back of the head, right? It was one of those things all the time. And he kept doing it more and more. And it wasn't like I was getting annoyed, but I was also like afraid to fight, right? Didn't know what was going on. I was growing up. And so I remember one day got up and just freaking, you know, hauled off and knocked the shit out of this kid, you know, and of course he came back at me pretty hard and I was like, oh shit. And I started running. Right. And I ran a couple hundred yards, man, and ran around the building. And I remember it was an afternoon, probably around 5 o'clock, you know, we had these balconies on the apartments. There were four stories, and we lived on the fourth floor. My dad was on the balcony barbecuing, and I'm freaking hauling. I can see him up there. I'm like, Daddy! And you can't get in the building unless somebody rings you in, mm-hmm. right? You have to push a button to let you in. So I knew that, you know, there's going to be a delay going through that door. So I had to get my dad, right? Open the door, right? And he's looking, he's like, what the fuck? And he saw this kid chasing me. And I remember he looked at me, you know, yelled at me. He goes, I ain't opening his door. He said, you better turn around, fight. When you come up here, I'm going to beat your ass, right? And I'm like, shit. So I turn around and got onto it with the kid and beat him up. So I was good, right? So otherwise I would have got two ass whoopings that day. But that was typical of my father, man. Yeah. And I remember one time, you know, and then I got in a lot of fights with one of my best friends, man, all the time over girls, man. And all the time. I don't know what the deal was with this guy. Now that I look back, I think he was actually gay, right? Everything about him, when I think about it, I was like, Michael was gay, man, because of the things he did and said and the way he acted, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't treat him any differently. He was my friend, my best friend. But now that I look back, I'm like, actually, he used to bake cakes all the time, right? We'd go to his house, he's baking cakes. And then he taught me how to bake cakes. And I hate to say it, but I actually still bake cakes. I still make cakes. I'm pretty good at it.
I bet you make great cakes.
Dude, I make some really good cakes. I just made one for my daughter before I left, you know? And so I showed her how to do it, you know? Passing it on, you know, the family recipe, you know, from from Mama Dale. And so, but he and I would get in fights all the time, man. You can't see on my finger right now, but I punched him in the mouth one time in the swimming pool, right? We were swimming in the public pool. We were fighting over a girl, and I hit him so hard that his tooth went through my finger and about took off part of my knuckle, right? And the blood's all in the swimming pool and shit, you know, and he's running out screaming and hollering, you know, like, God damn it, you know? But we were fighting all the time. And I remember one night getting a fight. It was dark and we got in a fight under a streetlight. Probably, again, I don't remember what that fight was over. I don't know if it was over a girl, probably a girl. There was one girl there named Phoebe, man. We love Phoebe, man. You know, she's like, oh, you know. Dudes, man, testosterone, right? She probably didn't like either one of us, you know. But anyways, we're out there and we get in a fight and we're rolling around on the asphalt. And then my dad was coming out. He was going to go across the street to I had five brothers. They were friends of mine. They all five brothers, and their dad was pretty cool. You know, he played country and western, but this was an army concern.
Yeah.
My dad was friends with their dad, you know, and he's going to go over and have beers with the old man. And he sees me out there duking it out with this other kid on the street. Right. I mean, like, I'm rolling around on the ground on top of this kid, you know, and my dad walks over and he's looking like, what the hell? And he's still drinking a beer. I remember he used to love drinking Coors beer. And he doesn't interfere. He's not going to try to stop it. You know, I remember he looks down at me and he's drinking his beer and he's like, you better kick his ass, son. You don't kick his ass. Don't come home tonight, right? And he's drinking his beer, you know, like, I'm like, okay, Dad. And my dad leaves and I'm still out there duking out with the kid, you know? And that was just how it was, you know? And then we got done beating each other up, got up, shook each other's hand, you know? And I bet he and I had at least 10 fights in the time that I knew him. Serious fisticuff fights, but that's how it was, you know, and that's how I grew up. And you know, you didn't run from a fight. If you did, you know, you got your ass kicked, you know, and you're gonna get your ass kicked again and again and again until you stand up and, you know, and face down the threat and at least face them. You know, you might take a beating, but at least you stood up and tried. Mm-hmm. And usually when that happened, almost always, you know, you got respect.
Yeah.
I was playing basketball one time. So one of the things I like to do as a teenager is I would go out to, you know, the military gyms, right? And play basketball with the GIs out there, right? And I just love playing basketball. I was actually really good at it. And I like going out and playing with, you know, the guys, you know, and there were a couple other dudes there was this one really buffed Asian dude, man, in my high school. I remember it. And for whatever reason, he just didn't like me. I don't know why, but he just didn't like me. And he's playing there at the gym one day with these guys, and he's on the other team, and I'm on this team. And we're the only teenagers playing with these GIs, you know, in their 20s. And for whatever, I can't remember what happened, what caused this fight, but I'm holding the basketball, and this guy's constantly blah, 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 talking shit. And finally, everything just kind of stopped from holding the basketball. And he walks up to me and just punches me. Whoa. And I'm like, I'm still holding the basketball, and all the GIs are like, whoa, right? And they're not trying to stop. They're just like looking like, what's going to happen now, right? And I remember, like, and I just just dropped the basketball. My eye was watering on one side. He hit me so hard. I just dropped the basketball, hauled off, and clocked him again, you know, and freaking hit him pretty hard. And then we got into it, and then the GIs broke it up. And then after that, he and I became friends. It was like your truth. Like, okay, you're good, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and so, but that's how you grew up, and that's how I grew up, you know? And so my life growing up was, you know, it was centered on athleticism. We all played sports all the time. You know, we were all very conservative because our military culture that we grew up with. You know, we were the guys, you know, we gender roles, you know, boys were boys and girls were girls. Boys chased the girls. Girls would run from boys, you know.
And it
was just, that's how, you know, I grew up, man. That's what I'm so used to, you know.
Yeah.
And then somewhere along the way, shit started changing. It's like, you know, now there's no such things as girls and boys. They're they and these and z's and whatever hell they, you know, they come up with. And it's like, have we lost our minds, man? And so and that's part of the reason I wrote this book, man, because I want people and young men that's particularly to look and go, damn, that's how it was.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that culture, it was that you know, it was those times that created the men of today, you know, and comparatively speaking, I hope to look at me and my peer group and those of us in my age group, you know, and go, you know, would I rather be a guy like that? Or would I rather be a guy like this, some goofy guy? And I'll use, sorry, so there.
Yeah, you're good.
I got a phone coming. You know, would I rather be a guy like, you know, I'll use Zuckerberg, right? Or, you know, Daughtry.
Yeah.
Let me tell you something. Those guys are pussies.
Yeah.
All right? They're wimps. Oh, yeah, they got a lot of money. Okay, that's all they got is money. All right? That's all they got. They are not men. They're not even close to men. All right? They're geeks. All right? And so a lot of people want to be like that all because they got money. Let me tell you something. I work around people with money, big money. Most of my partners were billionaires, okay? I've coached millionaires, all right, performance coach. And I can tell you, just because you have a lot of money doesn't mean you have a good life. In fact, your problems are proportional to your bank account, right?
Yeah.
The more money you make, the more issues you got.
More money, more problems.
And they have no life. They have no life, man. I've been with these guys. I watched them, you know? They have these big fancy yachts. They go out there for about 2 hours and go, yeah. Okay, that was kind of cool. Now what are we going to do? Shit, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, it's like boring.
Yeah.
You bought a boat and it sucks, right?
Yeah.
For 2 hours, right? And oh, what, chicks? Oh, yeah, you can get a bunch of girls for your money, but I can get a bunch of girls too, and I don't need money.
Yeah.
Right? And so, you know, win-win. But anyways, you know, so I'm saying all this because, you know, and maybe I'm a dying breed, man. Maybe I'm a dinosaur. Maybe nobody wants to be like me.
Sure.
I mean, a lot of people don't, man, right? When you look at what's going on today, you know, people talk about toxic masculinity. Well, I'm that toxic guy, apparently, you know, and I'm not what they want around. But I can tell you, I'm the kind of guy they need around. Because in America and in the West, we might have a bunch of, you know, androgynous males. Now, that might be the end thing, you know. We want these guys are effeminate, you know, and no threat to everybody and the women, blah, blah, blah. But I could tell you in the rest of the world, they're not buying into that. Their men are becoming men. They're becoming more manlier.
Yeah.
They're starting to look at our culture in the past and go, man, that's what we need to be like. And they're finally getting to that level. You know, you go to Afghanistan, Africa, you know, the Middle East, Asia, Southeast Asia, man, you got 10-year-old boys running around AK-47 shooting people in the face and not even losing any sleep over it, man.
Yeah.
You know, and so our enemies are getting stronger and we're getting weaker.
Yeah.
And let me tell you something, man. Well, you know, we need, you know, computer geeks, electronics, you know, and we're, you know, technologically we'll win the next war, we'll be more superior. No, because you know what? Every battle comes down to the guy on the battlefield with a weapon. At the end of the day, it comes down to that guy. Okay, your technology is not going to win every war because at the end of the day, you still got to take out that dude with a gun and a bad attitude.
Yeah.
And so we don't have, we're starting to lose that, man. We're starting to lose that. And we're losing even more because now we're going, well, we need to have women in our special operations, you know, because it needs to be, you know, we need to be all inclusive, man. Let me tell you something. you're going to get a lot more people killed. Don't even get me going down that road right now. But anyways, so in ways, that's kind of my growing up, my childhood, right? It's kind of, you know, it was a rough and tumble type thing. I looked up to this day, my favorite actor is Clint Eastwood, even though he's an actor. In my mind, he just, he really epitomized what I thought a real man was like, and John Wayne. That's like, that's who I want to be like, And my dad, in a lot of ways, was like Clint Eastwood. Actually reminded me of him a little bit. So that takes me into the next part called the patriarchs, right? And the patriarchs are the men that influenced me the most growing up. And it's important that we have that, I think. You know, we look at a lot of families today, and, there's no father in the household, right? And divorce rates are through the roof. Some families, particularly minority families, what is it, like 70% don't have a father figure in the house. Look, I've been divorced more than once. I'm actually ashamed to say how many times I've been married. But, my excuse for that is, I spent my entire life as a soldier, not just, or a soldier, in the barracks. I'm talking about a soldier deployed, In every conflict from Grenada in 1983 to the present conflicts in Yemen, as a soldier, as a combat armed soldier, whether in special forces, whatever it was, I was deployed a lot. When I worked for OGA, I spent 9.5 years, almost 9 months out of the year for 9.5 years gone. Why? Because I'm trying to make money so I can put my kids through college, put a nice roof over my wife's head, trying to take care of everybody, and it was a huge expense, there's a huge expense assigned to that. And, I look back, I've lost so much money. I've lost millions of dollars, man, millions and millions of dollars. I've lost everything, man. I've lost my children, and have walked away with nothing more than once. Right. And I look at it and go, well, that's the price, I guess, I pay for the work that I do. And is anybody forcing me to do that? Absolutely not. It's a labor of love. And my mom once asked me, she goes, son, she goes, why do you do this? She goes, let them do it. Why do you do this? I go, Mom, if I don't do it, who's going to do this? Who's doing this? Right? How many guys are lining up going, I want to be a paratrooper, infantryman, a Green Beret, a Delta Force operator, paramilitary operative for OGA? Who's signed up for that shit? Very few people. And those that do, a lot of them don't even have the metal to make it, And so, and all we got to do is look around today. Nobody wants a fight. Most of the weenies in America, they don't want to fight because they're scared. Why? Because they didn't grow up. They didn't grow up in the culture that I grew up, where it was rough and tumble. You didn't cry to mommy because somebody bullied you, and invoke anti-bullying laws. You freaking stood your ground. My mom and dad, they didn't come to my aid. They're like, get your ass out there and fight.
Yeah.
If you don't fight, take your ass whooping.
Yeah.
That's how it is, right? And so, but today we want to coddle everybody, coddle our kids. And now we've got a generation that, nothing solves, violence doesn't solve anything. They come up with all kinds of excuses. Why not to be a man? Why not to be a warrior? Why not to be, strong, They come with all kinds of reasons why they need to be effeminate, and androgynous, and wear skinny jeans and not have muscle, and have a, the little man bun bullshit going on, right? So, I said it, man bun bullshit. Ponytails, right? Nah, I'm not gonna knock them for that, man, but anyways.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a different, it's a totally different mindset and a different culture. I owe a lot to my parents, my father, my German grandfather, my German uncles, and there's actually two Americans I'm going to talk about towards the end that I've had a huge effect on my life, right? There's actually six men total in my life that I feel like have had a lot of influence on me, my profession, my ethics, and all those, and created the guy that I am today, right? Give me that courage, gave me that the confidence to be, better than I was yesterday.
Yeah.
So my dad, a little bit about my dad.
Dale, I'm gonna go run and piss real quick. I need you to monologue for 30 seconds. Tell him where to buy American Badass.
Okay, where do you buy American Badass? Well, actually, you can buy my book on Amazon.com. It's that's the only place it's available. And so the reason I'm doing this podcast with Tommy, you know, is to talk about each one of my chapters in my book. And it kind of gives you, you know, basically the gist of the stories that are in the book. You know, the book's written a little differently. It is written in my own words, and it goes a little bit more detail. But people ask me all the time, you know, for an audio version of it because I don't have time to read. Honestly, the book can be read in about 4 hours. If you just sit down, you can read it in about 4 hours. It's an easy read. I didn't make it too thick intentionally because I was told by my management team, who's authored many books, that most people will only read about 30% of a book and then they'll put it down, regardless how good it is, right? And so I wanted to make it, you know, not so lengthy that you could actually read the whole thing and get something out of it. In fact, if you look at some of the podcasts out there, look at the attention span most people have anyways. It's not very long. An hour podcast, most people will watch it for 15, 20 minutes, right? The book is no different. So I try to keep it condensed, you know, so that you can get the most out of it. And as I said before, it's not about, the book's really not about me as much as it's about you. That's what I tell people all the time, right? There's a lot in it that you'll learn about yourself, or at least make you think about things about yourself. So going back to my father, as I said, you know, he joined the Army when he was 17. He lived out in near Bishop, California. It's on the east side in the Sierra Nevada mountains, kind of like on the base of the mountains towards the desert. Mm-hmm. And he lived a very poor, austere life. You know, my grandfather drove a snowplow in the winter just to make ends meet. They were very poor. And so my dad joined the Army when he was 17th, right out of the 11th grade, and off he went. He met my mom. My mom was, you know, she's German. She had a ninth grade education. Her only training was to be a seamstress, sewing, and that's what happened, right? And then they, you know, I can remember, well, my mom tells me all the time that at that time, her family didn't want her to marry my father because, you know, they called him an ummy. Right, American, right? And that was like, you know, you can't marry the Americans, you know, and they're scum of the earth, you know, that type of thing. So there's a lot of resentment and dislike for them, but, you know, just like racism and anything else. But, you know, it worked out, and then they all ended up loving my father, and, you know, and it was a great time growing up with my family over there, you know, really cool. And so I learned a lot, you know, from my father. My father had a lot of integrity. He always looked out for me and my sister. He didn't beat us. I'm not going to lie and say he never beat us. He beat the shit out of me a few times, but I had it coming.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I was a rambunctious teenager at times, and I did some stupid stuff, and I deserved it. And I don't remember my sister ever getting spanked, but I sure do. And anyways, but I'm okay with that, right? It didn't mess me up. Yeah. And didn't psychologically affect me, at least I don't know about. And maybe my ex-wives will disagree, but no, which is kind of ironic, right? I've never become like a violent person. I've never struck my wives. Mm-hmm. I don't even spank my own kids. I'll put a spanking on the bad guys. You know, I was a fighter. I got, as you mentioned earlier, you know, 6 degree black belts, 1st degree black belts, a professional fighter, a professional soldier. And I put the smack down on a lot of dudes, you know, but I've never harmed my family. I'm like the family dog that's not allowed to bite the family, right? You can bite the tutors, but you don't bite the family. And that's kind of how I've always been, right? So kind of sheepdog, I guess. But anyway, so my dad taught me a lot, especially about integrity, about honesty. He was a good man. He was a really good man. My dad was a guy that helped everybody. He never, you know, never met a stranger. In fact, when he died, sadly, you know, 8-9 years ago now, man, time flies. My mom told me a story that none of us knew. And the only reason she found out about it was a nurse told my mother what happened. My father, he had a client, a very old lady. And finally, the family put this woman in a nursing home because they wanted to take care of her, you know. And so they put her in a nursing home, and she had nobody. Nobody came to visit her, nothing. Nobody was there for her, her family. Nobody was there for her. And my dad would go by there once a week and go visit her and just sit down with her and shoot the shit and bring her, you know, treats and stuff, whatever she wanted, you know. And he became basically her son for many years. And he never told anybody, ever. My mom didn't know. I didn't know. it was like a secret, not because he was hiding something. He just felt like he didn't need to tell anybody. It's like he's just doing this. It was selfless,
right? Doing the right thing.
Yeah. And after he died is when we found out about it. I was like, wow. And I got to tell you, man, that that really had an impact on me. I was like, man, that is probably the coolest thing that I can say about my dad, you know?
Yeah.
And it was after his death, it's the one thing that's really inspired me to be a better man. It's like, you know, I want to be like that, my dad, you know, and I want to do things and not tell people about it, you know, and help people. Yeah. Right. And so, so even in death, my dad taught me a great lesson, you know, that I will carry with me for until the day I die. Then there was my grandfather on my mother's side, same thing, you know, he was, my grandfather and my uncle, his son, had nothing after World War II, you know, there was nothing left, man, of their lives, you know? And, they, you know, I remember the stories they used to tell me about the Americans coming through the village, you know, and, you know, the Americans would come through the homes and they'd go into my grandfather's house and he had a cellar with wine and they'd go downstairs and they'd take all the wine and they'd pop the cork and they made my father take a grandfather take a drink out of it and make sure it wasn't poisoned. And then they would drink all the wine up, you know, and he had their way there, you know, partying in my grandfather's house, you know, my mom and my, you know, my grandma. And, you know, there were a lot of stories, you know, during that era growing up that, you know, was really interesting. You know, I learned a lot from my mom about, you know, being resilient. And she's a tough old lady, man. Even to this day, she's a tough old lady. And so those were my, you know, my dad was my real role model because he was my father. And I looked up to my father that I needed a man, you know, a male figure, you know. And so there was a lot of things that he could have done more for me. But what he did for me was enough. My grandfather did a lot for me. He also mentored me in a lot of ways. My grandfather and I would take long walks together. I'll never forget, man. He and I would go walking all the time down this one place called the Donau River, which was in a place called Lauingen in Germany, which is where my family lived. And I would always stay with him through the summers. And he would always want to go. That was kind of a pastime with Germans is going for a walk, right? Spazieren is what they call it, Spazieren. And especially on Sundays after dinner or lunch, you know, we have a big lunch. We go for a walk as a family, right? And I remember going for walks all the time. It was just my grandfather, you know, and running around and throwing rocks in the river, you know. And, you know, I was just a little guy and, you know, and my grandfather would keep the eye on me, you know. And we had this bond. And I remember one day, we came to visit and my father, my grandfather, my grandmother and my mother had a big argument. I don't even know what the hell they were arguing about, but it was a big fight. I'd never seen one like that before in my family. And my mom was like, that's it. We're not coming back. Blah, 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 blah. And she grabbed me and my sister and we got in the car and we drove away. We had about 2 hour drive just to get back home. And then we got the word the next day that my grandfather was gone. He had taken a bag of peanuts with him and his jacket and his hat. Nobody knew where he was. So my uncle, my father went looking for him and they found him down at the river where we always went for a walk, hanging from a tree and killed himself. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's kind of, you know, it's one of those things, man. I was like, wow, you know, that has a profound impact. Matt, moving forward, going forward in time, you know, when I was in the Army and I was in Delta Force, you know, we had three psychologists in the unit all the time. They were evaluating us. We had, you know, annual mental checkups and, you know, they wanted to make sure the machines were always, you know, functioning properly, not malfunctioning. And I remember one day a shrink told me that, you know, after he did my eval, he goes, you know, you have the based on my profile, you know, there's a possibility that I'm more likely to commit suicide than the average guy. Right.
Sure.
And, based off my profile, I remember thinking about my grandfather, I'm like, shit, my grandfather committed suicide. And I'm thinking, damn, I'm not going down that road, you know, and I'm going to defy those odds. And so here I am, still alive, right? So, but anyways, and then I remember one time walking with my father, my grandfather, he came to visit me and, you know, our family in the housing area, the Army military housing area. And a lot of times my grandfather and my grandmother would come and live with us for a couple of weeks, you know, they were so far away, which is easy for them to stay for a few weeks. I remember we went for our, you know, afternoon walk, me and my grandfather, through the housing area, the American housing area. And, you know, it's like anywhere else. You could tell a German from an American, right? And And so I'm walking with my grandfather, who looked like a German. You know, he wore the, you know, he wore the brim, you know, and the trench kind of coat, you know, and walked with his hands folded behind his back, you know, and he's a big guy. In fact, I look just like him now. When I look at the pictures, like, damn, you know, that's, I look like my grandfather. And I remember one day we're walking, and there were these American kids were playing around these cars, and my father and I were kind of walking down this dirt road next to the cars through the neighborhood. And the kids saw us, and then one of them ran out and ran right up to me, just punched me in the face. Just punched me in the face for no reason, right? I mean, haul off and nail me, man. And like, what? Because he thought I was a German. And so you could say it was, you know, he was being, I don't know if it's racist because we're both white, but, you know, he's freaking, you know, beat me, he punched me in the face because he thought I was a German, right? Yeah. And so when it happened, I remember it took me like a second to realize, holy shit, this guy just freaking waylaid me, right? But I didn't go down, and I actually chased him and caught him really fast, actually. I caught him within probably 25 feet of where it happened, right? And I threw him up against the car. And I remember my grandfather was just standing on the road, still had his hands behind his back, just kind of watching, you know, wasn't overreacting, didn't do anything, just kind of stood there and watched. And I freaking jammed this kid up against the car, man. I'm getting ready to freaking put him down, right? I mean, I had his ass to the dead to rights, right? And he's like, ah! And right before I punched him, I looked over at my grandfather. And I remember, I'll never forget, man, my grandfather looking at me like, what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. What are you going to do, you know? And I looked at him, and it's like time slowed down. And I don't know why I didn't punch the kid, but I felt like I didn't need to. I felt like I already won.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I looked at my grandfather and I looked at this kid and I just let go and walked away, you know, and the kid just kind of walked away like, whoa, you know? And I walked, my grandfather and I were holding hands, right? When we were walking, because I was not that big, you know? And I love my grandfather and that was kind of normal, right? He loved me, so probably that's why the American kids hit me, because like, look at their whole hand, you know? Yeah. And so I just walked back over to my grandfather. We didn't say a word. I grabbed his hand and we just started walking and never talked about it.
Yeah.
Just like nothing ever happened. It was the weirdest shit. I never will forget that. Right. Yeah. And I always wonder about the meaning behind all that, but, there was this serenity about the whole thing, you know? But I felt like, I didn't feel bad, like, you know, I just got punched in the face and didn't do anything about it. I actually felt like I won, right? Like, you know, I could have crushed this kid, but I didn't have to, Dad or Grandpa, you know? It was almost like my grandpa acknowledged that. It's like, you know, good job, man. You didn't have to hurt him. You won anyways, right? Yeah. So anyways, that was my grandfather, right? My uncle, who was his son, my mother's brother, you know, he was just a really cool guy, man. He, you know, hard worker, you know, it turns out he's very wealthy now. But he loved me like his son. He had two boys, my cousins. I was like one of the boys, you know, we did all kinds of fun stuff together, swimming. In fact, he actually spent more time hanging out with me than his own sons. You know, he would teach me how to go diving and snorkeling and we'd go together. He'd buy me knives, snorkeling knives. I mean, for some reason, it was almost like he enjoyed his time with me more than his own kids, which was really kind of strange. But his kids own the company now. So they're very rich.
Yeah.
Damn it.
Fuck.
But anyways, you know, but by his example, I learned a lot. I learned a lot from him. Just looking at him, I really idolized my uncle. You know, he's nice and fit and slim, you know, and very athletic. And his personality, I mean, he was just so fun to listen to, and he was the life of the party all the time, but he was tough, you know, he wasn't an idiot. So those two really had a profound effect on me, or all three of those, my uncle, you know, my grandfather, and of course my father. And then there was, you know, I said there were two Americans that had an effect on me also. And I really don't talk about it in the book. I probably should have, and I probably will in my next book, So the other guys, there's actually three men. Okay, so the next one was Gary O'Neill, and I'm going to give him a plug for his book. He wrote the book American Warrior. In 1983, I was in the 82nd Airborne Division, LRPS Platoon, Long Range Reconnaissance Platoon. I was a kid, man. I was 20, 21, somewhere around that time, right? And this was 19, This was 1983. We went out to Camp McCall in the October, maybe a little bit earlier. It was cold, I know that. And we go out there and we're going to do SEER training, survival, evasion, resistance, escape. And so we're all sitting in the class. We're all young guys, man. And we're all excited. You know, we're going to learn this cool special forces stuff. And then part of the program was the hand-to-hand combat portion, right? And that's where Gary O'Neill came in. He was going to teach that part. And so I remember in the morning, we walked outside, really cold, man, you know, like 6 a.m. And there was, you know, they call it the bear pit, right? It had sandbags all around and a big circle inside of sawdust. But the sawdust was real hard because it was, you know, frost on it, you know. Mm-hmm. So we would go out there and we stood in the big circle, you know. We had our green patrol caps on and our OG-107s, you know. And so Gary O'Neill came out and he had dark hair and just a tough guy. And he starts doing this demonstration. He's basically talking to us about, you know, mind, our mindset, you know, how it mindset is everything. And what I learned about Gary was he's a storied, you know, heroic Vietnam veteran. He was in the LARPs in Vietnam, survived, I believe, like 77 close ambushes. You know, he's got some amazing stories. He won the Silver Star when he was 15. He actually went in the Army and he used his cousin's birth certificate to get in and earned his first Silver Star, was found out. Was kicked out, and then his mom worked on the draft board, and she basically used his real records to get him back in, and so he came back in, right? So I mean, this guy's a badass, right? And it's a great book, man. And so I personally know Gary, and so anyways,
tell Gary to do the podcast.
Yeah, if I get a hold of him. For some reason, I haven't been able to get a hold of him lately, but I will. I'll try to get a hold of him.
Sure.
Anyways, he starts doing his demonstration, right? Talking about mindset. So first thing he does, he takes a bicycle spoke, he pulls the skin out on his neck and jams his bicycle spoke through his skin on his neck, right? And then he takes a water bucket that's full of water and it has a rope on it, on the handles, and he takes it, he loops it around the bicycle spoke, and now he's hands off. Right, this thing's dangling from his neck and he starts spinning around. I'm like, holy shit, right? And then he gets done, takes it all apart, and then he sticks these bicycle spokes through his arms, right? On the bottom of his arms, right? And then he hooks, again, water buckets to the bottom of those and he's lifting them up, spinning them around. I'm like, holy shit, right? And then the last thing he did was he laid down and he had a guy with a quarter ton Jeep drive over his belly. Right, and so we're like, what? And so, you know, we're learning this guy's really into all kinds of martial arts and hand to hand and mindset stuff, you know, and stuff that I'm kind of teaching now. And I was like, wow, we were all like really impressed, right? And so it was from that point on, I realized at that moment that was my military mentor. That's who I wanted to model myself after. I want to be that kind of guy, man. Yeah. That kind of soldier. Right, this guy was Rambo, you know, times 10, man. And I really did in a lot of ways try to model my mindset to be like him. I wanted to be a warrior like this guy. You know, I read his story, you know, in Vietnam and everything he did. You know, he's Sioux Indian. I don't know, you know, if anybody knows that, but you know, that's his heritage, is Sioux Indian. You know, when I tell him that, you know, I got some Cherokee blood in me, he goes, those guys are a bunch of farmers. strike that.
Never mind.
but anyways, you know, so, you know, I follow him over the years and, you know, the guy's just, you know, I mean, he's just got some crazy stories, even as a bouncer and, you know, and he's just an awesome dude, man. Awesome guy. In fact, you go on Google or YouTube, you can see there's an interview with me and him on YouTube, Gary O'Neill. The other guy that was one of my mentors, a guy named Jim Smokey West. He was also a Green Beret, not a Vietnam vet, but he'd been around for a while. And again, this guy he still is a modern day Wyatt Earp with his hands, man. You just cannot beat this dude. This guy's a machine, man. A scary dude. And I can go on all day about his exploits and the fights that he's been in, and it's like, wow. I mean, and he's had his nose cut off with beer bottles. He's been shot, stabbed, you know. He's just a train wreck, but this guy's like he's like a machine. He's like a robot, yeah. Man. He's like a cyborg, man. And anyways, long story short, I went to him because my son at the time was 4 years old and he loved Ninja Turtles, right? And he goes, Dad, I want to be a karate guy, blah, 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 blah. And so I said, okay, you know, if you're going to start this, you have to finish it. You know what that means? You're like, no, you got to get a black belt, right? You okay with that? Yeah, Dad, are you there? Okay. And I had to look around and I took him to a school that, you know, like the YMCA, you know, and that was nothing more than a daycare. I wasn't happy. And I called a friend of mine. I said, hey, dude, I said, Bart, man, I said, you told me about this other guy that has a martial arts school. He's pretty badass. Who is that guy? And he told me, he goes, that's Jim Smokey West, man. Here's his address. He's training right now. Go over to his place. I literally grabbed my kid up out of the YMCA in his karate uniform. I said, come on. This is bullshit. We're going to go somewhere else. And I took him over there. And when I walked in, I see all these little kids out on the floor, right, with these big wiffle ball bats and foam on. And they're beating the shit out of each other, right? It's just chaos, man. Why? And they're having a fun punching and kicking and stuff. And I introduced myself to Jim. And he's like, yeah, man. He tells my son, hey, you want to go play? He's like, yeah. And he runs out there and they're just duping it out, fighting, you know, beating the fuck out of each other. And I go, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. You know, get it on. You know? Yeah. And so that's how it started. And then my kid really liked it, you know, and it was organized. But, you know, Jim had a way of doing, you know, bringing out that warrior spirit in these kids, you know. And Jim's he's a Green Beret, you know, and I got to tell you, man, when I first met Jim West, the guy was freaking scary, man. And I'm not easily scared by people, but when I met Jim, I'm like, holy shit, man, this guy is freaking crazy. Yeah, right? Yeah. He's a good dude, but he will fuck you up. Yeah. And I remember it had such an impact on me that I went home that night. When I went to sleep, no shit, because I'd heard all the stories already, right? No shit. I had a dream. He punched me in the face and grabbed my wife at the time and just started kissing her. Like, what are you going to do about it? And I'm like, nothing. I'm like, nothing happened, you know? Yes. Ow. Yeah. There's some real life stories like that, man. This guy is just amazing, right? And so I said, look, my son was happy. He wanted to go there. I thought about it. I go, shit, if I'm going to bring my kid here every day to train with him, so why don't I come over here and train with him?
Yeah.
So my son and I both started training with Jim West. In 3 years, by the time my kid was 7, he got his first degree black belt. Same with me, right? And so I ended up getting my 6th degree black belt through Jim. And I was one of only 2 fighters that Jim had, amateur and professional. The other one was a girl named Judy, who was pretty badass. She was an Air Force captain, but we were the only 2. Jim was very strict about who trained with him and who fights for him. He didn't have time to bullshit around, waste his time, you know, and for you to go, I don't want to fight anymore. He wanted people with heart, and he would test you. He made sure you had the heart. He damn near knocked me out one time, and I bounced back to my feet and said, okay, I'm ready to go again. He goes, nah, you're not ready to go again. He goes, you're hurt. He goes, but... He goes, I respect your enthusiasm, you know, your heart. And that's when he knew I had the heart to fight.
Yeah.
And I love fighting, man. I freaking fought all the time. I actually did the first Ballytudo, anything goes, no holds barred fight in the USA back in 1995, 96 in Richmond, Virginia. I turned pro as a boxer and kickboxer under him. And I couldn't get enough, man. I really couldn't. And so... That was Jim, you know, and Jim is the kind of guy, you either like him or you don't. And I used to tell everybody, go, you know what, I don't go to gym for my morals or my ethics or anything else. I'm a grown man. I go to gym because Jim knows how to fight, mm-hmm. and I want to learn how to fight like him. I want my son to learn how to fight. My son's going to get his morals, his ethics from me, right? And not saying that Jim didn't have them, he did. Sure. Jim was the kind of guy, he intimidated a lot of men. And when men are intimidated, you know, and they're scared of you. They talk shit behind your back, right? Because that's the only way they can freaking puff up. But nobody had the balls to get in his face. And the ones that did, you know, they would get their ass handed to them. They'd come into his classroom and literally, it was like a gunfight at the OK Corral. Come in and challenge him, you know? My kung fu's better than your kung fu, you know? I want to fight, you
yeah.
know? You know?
Yeah.
And he'd be like, okay. You know, fight over, man. I can tell you some amazing stories about Jim. I'll save that for another podcast. In fact, we're going to have Jim on the podcast. You got to hear
fuck
the stories,
yes.
man.
Please do.
This guy's a machine, man. And to this day, he's still a machine.
Please
he's
do.
Late 60s?
Dale, please get him to come on, please.
Yeah, I will have him on there, man. Maybe, yeah, I will get him on there. Remind me to do that. So he was my other mentor, right? So I learned how to fight through him. I learned about mindset through him. And, man, the guy is just phenomenal, man. He trained with Jim Lewis, Bill Wallace. He trained with a lot of the greats coming up, man.
Well, so and, I'm writing down his name, so I remember to text you after this. First guy.
Yes, Jim West, Smokey. Well, he goes by Smokey, but Jim West. He's on Facebook, too.
And the first guy was Gary? The other guy?
Gary O'Neill. O'Neill, he wrote the book American Warrior.
All right.
Which is funny. He wrote the book American Warrior the same time I wrote American Badass. I didn't even know that, right?
Really?
And I'm like, well, that's funny because my mentor wrote a book and I wrote a book. And, you know, hey, we're both Americans and he's a warrior and I'm a badass.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So it was kind of cool. But and then my sixth mentor, he's actually recent. I say recent in the last couple of years. So I had a guy call me. I can say his name, I think. His name's David Fabricius, and he was on my Facebook page and been on it for a while. I didn't know that, really didn't know anything about him. And one day he calls me and says, hey, I'd like to talk to you about your performance coaching, training. So we got talking. I told him what I do, what it's all about, he listened quietly, and then I went on to tell him at the end, I said, I did a kind of a comparison. I go, look, man, I've coached everybody. I've coached, you name it, photographers, policemen, millionaires, people with no money, all walks, teachers, all walks of life. Man, I've coached a lot of different people, different professions, right? Men, women, young and old. And I was telling that, and I was telling about, even very rich people. I said, man, I have one guy flies me literally around the world, to come and coach him because, over something like, he got the wrong goddamn boat lift. He ordered a boat lift for $2,000 and got the wrong one. And he feels like he got chewed out of it. He just couldn't cope with that. I'm like, really? These are rich people problems, right? Yeah. And they would fly me around the world to come and say, hey, it's okay.
Yeah.
We'll get you another one. Right. Oh my God. So we were laughing. Right. And I get done with him, and he's commences to tell me that at one point he was one of the in the top 1% income earners in the world. Like, oh shit, And then I learned he's like an international coach that's coached, Fortune, 250 companies around the world. He does a lot of stuff. He's lived in over 140 countries. He hung out with the Dalai Lama. He was hunting with the Zulus on the wherever, man. I mean, guy's been everywhere, right? Done everything. And he's very well spoken. He came to the United States from South Africa. He was a Green Beret, a Special Forces guy in South Africa. He came to the U.S. on a special, what do you call it, special talent and knowledge visa, right? Just because the guy was just amazing, right? He came over to the U.S. and actually lived on the street, right? Actually was homeless. And then one day broke the code and did very well and became very... very famous, very wealthy, I guess. And he's been doing a lot of coaching. So I'm like, well, what are you calling me for? Right. And he's like, well, he goes, any coach worth his salt is always going to try to learn more. Right. And you're going to reach out to other coaches to learn. Right. Because you can always better yourself. I thought, like, well, yeah, that's pretty respectable. You're right. And I appreciate you, considering me. And so that led to me coaching him. And then that led to him inviting me to seminars with him and also providing coachings and trainings and things like that. And what I find really cool is he always refers to me as coach in front of everybody. My man, I'm looking up this guy. He's calling me coach, And he's done really good things for me and he's been very gracious. And but the reason he's one of my mentors is because he's so knowledgeable on marketing, on business, on investing, on the psyche of it all. And, just his style and his charisma and his presentation and how he performs, man. I mean, he looks like a TV evangelist to some degree, but he's in his 60s, but man, he's a ladies' man. I mean, he's James Bond, And so, and I'm like, wow, this guy's pretty damn amazing. We have our, he's got his, I got mine. We are both unique in our way, But I looked at him and go, okay, I can definitely learn something from this guy, And we've become very good friends. And I love the guy, man. He's great. His name's David Fabricius. You might want to look him up. He's, you know, highly recommend him to you as well. But and I looked at him one day, actually a year ago. We did a seminar with a speaking engagement with about 7,000 attendees in Las Vegas. And when it was all over, I looked at him. I said, man, you know, I had 5 mentors in my life, and now I got 6, you know, and you're one of them. You've taught me something about another dimension that I really didn't know and wasn't really quite aware of until I heard you speak and I saw you do it. It's like, I learned something, man. That's fucking awesome, you know? And so I consider him one of, you know, and I tell you, man, to be one of my mentors, man, you really got to be a stellar individual, man, you know? I'm not saying he's perfect. I'm not saying anybody was perfect. You know, we're all, man, we all have vices, man. We're born with sin. So we're not perfect, but we all try hard to be good, you know, and that's what American Badass is all about. It's about being good, you know. I'm far from perfect. Ask my ex-wives. Not that I really care what they think, but, you know, they'll tell you a lot of lies too. But I'll tell you one thing. I'm a great father. I am a great father, man. I have never forsaken my kids. Never will. They're all that matters as far as I'm concerned. You know, women come and go, but kids, nah, they're constant, man. And so it's important that I treat them right, give them the right example. You know, and I do try to demonstrate I always demonstrate the right example. You know, my wives will tell them about the wrong examples because that's what makes them feel good and powerful over me.
Yeah.
You know, but to turn the kids against you. But at the end of the day, my kids aren't buying it. I know they're not. Yeah. Especially my oldest ones didn't buy it. And my youngest ones, they'll figure it out too. But I still have a good relationship with them. But at the end of the day, you know, as a man, it's important that, you know, we can, you know, go lay our heads down at night and feel good about who we are, that we've done the right thing. You know, we're not perfect. We're going to make a lot of mistakes. As long as we recognize that and know that, and we try not to do that again, or try to rectify that, that's okay, you know. But nobody's ever perfect. I'm far from that. And, you know, my wife always tells me, she goes, man, you're like 95%. My wife loves me, man. She's like, you're 95% perfect, you know. She goes, just 5% of you, man. It's just 5% of you. She goes, I can accept that, you know, because it's that 5% of imperfection that actually makes you perfect, you know, because of that, right? Yeah. And so can you imagine someone that was perfect? You'd be like skeptical all the time. Like, oh, come on.
Couldn't trust them. Couldn't trust them. You'd
right,
be like.
Right. That's right. Yeah. That's right. And so, and my wife knows that. She knows who I am and who I'm not.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not perfect. I'm not going to pretend to be perfect. It is what it is, you know, and I always tell my women, it's like, you know, here I am. This is what you get. I'm very straight up.
Mm-hmm.
I reveal everything. I don't care. You judge me if you want. If you don't like it, that's fine. But anyways, you know, it's all about being true, being yourself. And, you know, that's what this is all about. That's what my stories are all about. Hopefully, you know, there's something that is some takeaways for people there that think about, you know, and particularly guys that maybe never had a father figure, or maybe had a father figure that was just bad, you know. And, you know, at least now, you know, no matter what you do in life, and I'll end it with this, you know, at the end of the day, man, even the Bible says that. And by the way, I'm not a, you know, trust me, I'm not a Bible thumper,
sure.
Not even close, man. Sure. But, you know, I studied, ready for this? I actually studied theology, right? So, you know, I have a background in religion and you know, in Christian, in Christ and things like that. But, you know, even the Bible says, you know, at some point, you know, you have to put away your childish ways, yeah. Right? And usually it's around, you know, in your teenage years, you're expected, you know, put your childish ways away and become an adult, right? And so I look at, you know, the world today, and I look at people that always blame their childhood experiences, you know, what their mom and dad did to them, you know, or whatever, right? Somebody did to me when I was little. That's why I'm a train wreck today.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not a psychologist either, but I would argue that, you know, at some point you got to take responsibility for who you are today and your actions, right, moving forward. And you can't always turn around and point backwards. It was that guy's fault. Well, I'm a dickhead today, right?
Yeah.
Because you'll go through your whole life that way. And really, the irony of it is, by the time you're 35 years old, you already have 95% of your programming in you. So if you're up to the age of 35, you know, you're living in the past. Everything you know, you do, your behavior is all centered on all past behavior, all past knowledge, all past experiences, you know, all those things that have been imparted on you. And maybe they're not necessarily good. You know, there's an extremely high likely, you know, probability that today you're going to act based on your past. Tomorrow you're going to act on based on your past, right? And you can't expect your future to change if you're still acting from the past, yeah, right? Yeah. And so you've got to take it every day as a new day and basically forget the past, okay? Your past experiences, and look at the today and tomorrow from a different perspective, a different lens. Go, you know what? Because here's the other thing, right? 50 to 70% of the information that you have in your head is wrong.
Yeah.
It's false.
Yeah.
Half of what you know is actually wrong.
Yeah.
Right? And so you have to challenge that all the paradigms. You have to ask yourself, wait a minute, why do I feel like this?
Yeah.
Right? Why do I think that?
Yeah.
That my mom said it was wrong. My dad said it was wrong. My friend said it was wrong. Or that's what I heard on the news. And you realize one day, shit, that was all bullshit.
Yeah.
Right? And so you get to this point in life, you're like, dad, damn, if I'd have known that, I wouldn't have done this. I would have done it this way, right? Yeah. I'd be far better off. So really every day should be a new beginning where you have a new perspective. You look at things differently, right? Analyze it before you move forward. And if you can do that starting today, tomorrow will be better.
Yeah.
And your life will continue to improve and you'll see more success. You and I had a conversation earlier. I won't go into the details, but you know, you told me you applied something that I had told you to think mm-hmm. about. You know, I basically told you to think about mm-hmm. Where you want to be, you know, financially, professionally, personally. Think about where you want to be in the here and now, like it's actually real. Don't think about how you want to get there. Just think about that you're there.
Yeah.
And it'll become so. And you've told me that you have reached that, that goal in life. That dream, actually, it's just one of your dreams, I think, because I know there's more coming for you, right? And but you hit that benchmark. You went, holy shit.
It worked.
It actually happened. It worked, right? And so because you changed your way of thinking when I talked to you about it, mm-hmm. right? Otherwise, you probably would have been thinking about the past.
Yeah.
You'd have been thinking about, how do I make it work? How do I make it work? You know, I can't make it work. You know, we got you out of that mindset. Or you got yourself out of mindset based on what I told you. And when you change that, you challenge that paradigm and switch that way of thinking, guess what?
Whole new reality.
Yeah. So that, you know, with that said, so we're up past our time now, but that takes us into the next chapter, which I'll actually talk about. I'm going to talk about things like autogenic conditioning. I'm going to talk about the metaphysical world and how frequency affects every aspect of our life. You know, that success is based on frequency, on energy, literally on energy. It has nothing to do with philosophy. It has nothing to do with, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. It ain't got shit to do with that.
Yeah.
Right. Because if that's what it was all about, everybody that had a New Year's resolution would have met that New Year's resolution. Right.
Yeah.
How many people actually fall through under New Year's resolution? Very few people. Usually within 2 weeks, like, fuck that.
Yeah.
You know, and it's gone, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, they felt they relied on a philosophy, a flawed philosophy and way of thinking. And that's where they fell short. There's another way to do this that will guarantee success if they believe it, right?
Fuck
and that's what you have to believe it, right?
Yeah.
So we'll talk about that next time in the next chapter.
Hell yeah.
So
hell yeah. And I'll send you a text about those. I'm gonna stop recording, but don't go anywhere, Dale. For everybody listening, American Badass will be in the description, sticking to the top comment. And volume three, whatever the fuck you want to call it, will be next week. And again, everybody, Rumble, BitChute, because the big tech communists are coming down. So, one second, let me stop.